Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary Meller, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here at the university, locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers online classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our website, www.hinckley.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is The Impact, or Egypt Today, Tragedy or Opportunity, Islam, Democracy, and the Crisis of Good Governance. Today's guest is Dr. James Mayfield, the co-founder of Choice Humanitarian, author, professor emeritus of public administration and Middle East studies here at the University of Utah. He's also a consultant for governments in over 15 countries and has been a professor of Middle East studies since 1967 and has been studying villages in Egypt as a student, professor, researcher, trainer, manager, and consultant for over 40 years. Please join me in welcoming today's guest.
It's my pleasure to be here today. After having taught here for so many years, it's always nice to come back and be with students and with friends. And I hope I have a chance to share with you something that has been a passion of mine for almost 50 years. I arrived in Egypt in September of 1966. Yuck, it's a long time ago. And I was a young Fulbright and spent a year there living in three different villages, preparing information for my PhD in local government of Egypt. What I thought I would do is to start with the name of a book that I've just finished called Field of Reeds. This is, in Arabic, this is Zahat A'aru, which means Field of Reeds. And this is a pharaonic term, and it refers to the Nile Valley in its pristine, perfect role. It represents kind of the life after death. When you die, you go to a field of reeds. And the Nile River is a pristine, clear blue, which you know if you've been there is now a yucky brown. And the corn grows higher than you can reach. And there are no mosquitoes, no bugs. In this field of reeds, life in the Nile Valley is a paradise. And I use this term symbolically to suggest that while Egypt is no paradise today, and it wasn't a paradise even in the times of the pharaohs, but it implies a vision, an opportunity, a hope, that with proper systems of government and with people committed to tolerance and working together, that it would be possible. It would be possible to create a society that they would call a field of reeds. Now, if you look at the villages of Egypt, let's see, I'll go back one. Usually when you think of Egypt, you think of the pyramids. That's the first thing that comes to mind. And the pyramids are in the center, partially in the, sort of at the base of the delta that goes up into the Mediterranean. And this picture was taken in 1996 when I was, at the time, it was actually in March, which is the time of the Hamasim winds, and it's very dusty, and the winds come in from the desert, but it epitomizes the pyramids and agriculture, because historically 90% of the people living in the Nile Valley were farmers. We called them Fellahin. Fellah is the singular, Fellahin is the plural, the peasants of Egypt. And they, I like to think of Egyptian village. The great historian Herodotus called Egypt the gift of the Nile. But I would like to suggest that Egypt is a gift of the Fellahin. They are the ones who have toiled and produced and farmed this rich river valley over the centuries, providing the surplus, providing the food that has made it possible for the top 10% to create an amazing civilization. Now, there are in Egypt today about 5,000 villages. 1,000 of them they call mother villages, and these are villages of up to 20, 30,000 people. So it's really not a village, but it's called a village because it's not a town, which is usually over 50,000. And then there's another 4,000 villages called satellite villages, and they're usually about 10,000 each. And then there are 25,000 hamlets. So along this Nile Valley, this narrow Nile Valley, it averages across maybe from desert to desert, maybe 20, 30 miles at the most. And on this area of the Nile, 3% of Egypt is, well, let's say 97% of Egypt is desert. No agriculture, nobody, maybe a few Bedouins living in the desert. 3% of the land is arable, and on this 3% is where most of the 80 million Egyptians live today. So if you look at the Egyptian peasant in the 1960s when I arrived, 80-plus percent of the villagers in Egypt were living in a mud hut, much like this. And here is a fellah with his wife, and she is making butter. If you're wondering what she's doing, she's making butter as she shakes the milk and it turns to butter. If you look at how Egypt has changed, let me just show you. Mud houses, 86% let's see if I can make this work. Not sure I know how to make it work. No. Anyway. 86% were living in mud huts in 1966. It had dropped to 55%, and now, this in the last decade, it's down to about 20%, 18% in 2005. Homes with a tap that they could turn, 5% in 1966, 40% in 85, and now today, 86% of the village homes have access to potable water. A modern bathroom with a flush toilet, 3%, 15%, still two-thirds of the villages still go outside of their home to go to the bathroom. Electricity, this is an amazing statistic. When I arrived in 1966, less than 10% of the villagers had access to electricity. Notice what's happened. By 85, it was 42%. By 2005, it's 94, and I understand now in 2013, it's up to about 97% of all villagers have access to electricity. It's amazing. Who owned a radio? Well, radios were available in 86 in the villages, but only the elite would have a radio. And if you, in fact, went to 1985, two-thirds had radios, and today almost everybody has a radio in rural Egypt. Health centers, just to give you some changes. Notice there were about 260 health centers in 1966. It had jumped to over 700 today. Doctors per 100,000, 29 doctors. Now it's over 200 doctors. Death rate has dropped significantly from what it was in 1966 down to 5 per 100 per 1,000. The birth rate has dropped significantly, and I'll be talking about population because population is clearly the major challenge that Egypt faces. Limited amount of land and an expanding population makes the possibility of a field of reeds more than problematic. The infant mortality, this for me is a significant statistic. Notice it was 158 per thousand, 100,000 per thousand. In the United States, it's about 8 per thousand, okay? 158, in the United States, it's 8. But notice the progress that's been made in rural Egypt. It dropped to below 100 in the 80s, and today it's now around 30 per thousand. An incredible increase in the quality of life for the Egyptian peasant. I spent many, many days, months in villages, and I can tell you in the 60s, there wasn't a week that didn't go by when at least 5 or 10 families in a village I was living in had a child die from malaria, whooping cough, measles, deaths that we assume are easily prevented. But in the 60s, life expectancy was less than 40, and as you can see, the infant mortality rate was a tragedy. It has moved down significantly since that time. The Nile Valley is a beautiful valley, and one of the idyllic scenes in the morning, this was taken probably about 6 o'clock in the morning, and the young girls come down to the river to bathe, to wash themselves, and women have made a lot of progress in the last many years. Let's look at that. Women, young girls, many of them were married before they were 15. In fact, almost a third of all the girls married in 1966, 28%, were married before they were 15. It had dropped in the 80s, 17%, and today it's still 14%, but you can see there's been some progress. Female circumcision, which is a great tragedy in Egypt. When I was there, it was 99%. There's been a huge campaign to reduce that. But these kinds of traditions and these kinds of practices are difficult to eliminate. And it's still 80% in the rural areas of Egypt. The girls wearing a veil. It's interesting. When we think of Islam today, we think of women wearing a veil. But as a young graduate student in Egypt in the 60s, I almost never saw a woman wearing a veil in Egypt in the 1960s. Almost never. That had jumped in the 80s. And now in the villages, about 1 in 3 are now wearing veils. So we see that kind of cultural change. Using midwives, a daya, using midwives was the way to go in those early days. 78% of all births were attended by a midwife. Some of them trained well, some of them not trained so well. Infant mortality was very high during these years. But you can see now that the use of midwives has pretty well been significantly reduced. Most births now take place in a village clinic or in a village with a village doctor. Notice illiteracy. In 1952, 77% of the men were illiterate in the villages. But notice the females. 95% of the women living in villages could neither read nor write, nor had they gone to school. Women simply didn't go to school prior to 1952. By 65, when I arrived, roughly, females, it was still 88%. By 1985, it had dropped to 2/3 were still illiterate. And today, this 56 was 2005. The latest statistics I've seen from the United Nations tell me that now it's less than 50%. Then like 47% are still illiterate. But imagine going from 95% down to less than 50%. For me, that is significant progress. Okay, women in the villages work hard. And if you look at their conditions, you see they have primitive conditions. And it's a tough life. It's a tough life in the rural areas. Education, another significant progress. Number of schools from 6,000 up to 16,000. I said in 1900, less than 5% of the males would go to school in the villages. By 1952, about 25%, about 1 in 4 were going to school. In 1965, about 40% are going to school. And now today, in the 2010, it's close to 100%, 97% of the girls are now, of the children are now going to school. And in fact, this is the primary school. It's not quite 50%, but those children who do go to high school, now there are more girls in high school in Egypt today, in rural Egypt, than there were than are boys. It's up to, you can see, 50.7% of girls are now attending high school. Of those who are in high school, more than half of them are women. And so I'm trying to argue here that there are some very serious problems in Egypt, but there has been progress. There's been significant progress. I mean, I couldn't even imagine in 1966 that there would be 95% of the girls in villages going, the children going to school within 40 years. It didn't seem even possible. Okay, university training. Women in villages that had university training, maybe a few hundred in the whole country, might have gone to some university. That's not suggesting they graduated. That's suggesting they'd had some university training. Maybe a few thousand by the 1960s. Today, 3% of the men have now finished university, and 0.8%, less than 1% of women, in 1985. Today, it's interesting, in the villages today, 15% of the men in villages have college educations. Most of them work for the government. Many of them are engineers. They're muhandis zara'i, they're agricultural engineers. And you can see the progress in university education in the rural areas of Egypt. Okay, the traditional irrigation system. I was hoping I could make this work, but I haven't quite been able to figure out how to do it. So you'll have to look very closely. I want you to see the green fields. See the green fields. Above the green fields, you see the mountains of the desert. And I want you to contrast the desert, nothing grows. In the valley, you have this green, beautiful crop. And that's better seen. That's a crop of alfalfa. But notice this well. There's a cow, and he goes in a circle. And as he goes in a circle, the water jugs go down into the well. They come up, and the water comes out into the irrigation ditch. That was the common way for irrigation in the 1960s and in 70s, and even in the early 80s. Today, most of these wells are now managed by electrical pumps. The water is brought up. This was another, the Archimedean screw is another traditional technique. I don't know if you can tell, but these two boys at the front are turning a crank. And as they turn that crank, it brings the water from the lower canal up to the upper irrigation area. The Aswan Dam is the major change that certainly characterizes Egypt from today and in the past. For thousands and thousands of years, the Nile River would flood every September, October. And when it flooded, if it was a very high flood, it would literally destroy many of the villages. And usually you find these villages built up on a high mound so that the water wouldn't destroy their village. This dam stopped these floods. In 1964, they started building it. It was finished by 65. So that when I arrived in 66, there were no floods from then on because of this huge dam. Okay, farming is the life and blood of the rural areas. There's a farmer taking his crop of alfalfa to sell the market. You can see, and this is the tragedy that I hope you can understand. In 1966, less than 1 in 5 didn't have access owned land. One in five didn't have access to land. It had gone up to 32% that didn't have access. Today, almost half of the farmers, almost half of the people that live in rural Egypt do not have access to land. So how do they live? How do they live? And that is the challenge that I want to share with you if I can. Okay, acreage. You can see how agriculture has increased. Production has increased. Yields of produce increased. That's for wheat, corn. You can see the production scales. I won't spend a lot of time on these statistics, just to say to you that it's absolutely amazing, the production in terms of wheat and corn. This is a typical scene at harvest time in the valley. This, as you can tell, is a Christian village. And there you see the little Coptic church there. Christians are probably 10% of the population. 90% are Muslim. And most of these Muslims would be Sunni. And I was just going to show you rice. The production is the same there too. Okay, now the challenge of population growth. The total land density, if you divide the number of people per square mile in China, it's 357 people per square mile in China. 984 in India, and only 200 per square mile in Egypt. So you'd think, wow, that's not too bad. That's not too bad. But then let's look at the people per square mile by arable land. That is the number of people living in that Nile Valley. Okay? And you can see that in China it's 2,500 people per arable land. It's 2,000. Egypt, it's over 6,000 people per square mile. So the challenge of dealing with this growth and these problems is an amazing thing. Now, I want to show you very quickly the growth rate. In 1897, the population was 10 million people in Egypt. And the rural population was about 8. And the growth rate was 1.6. Now, 1.6 is not bad. That's not a problem. At 1.6, and most of that low birth rate or growth rate was due to the tragedy of sickness. I mean, when you have people dying at the rate they were dying and the diseases that existed during that time, it's not too difficult to see why it was a low growth rate. But now notice, 1967 is when it really exploded. Why did it explode in the 1960s? Very simply, the population exploded in Egypt because now there is vaccinations and there are medicines and there are ways of eliminating most of the major diseases that were destroying so many children and people. Now again, it levels off at about 2.6 in the 80s, and today it's now less. It's about down to what it was, 150 years ago. It's down to 1.7. How do you explain that? Very simple. It's not because they're being killed. They're dying because of disease. There's fewer births today because of the use of contraceptives. In 1966, when I interviewed villagers, less than 10%, 7.3, said that they had ever used birth control. Now using, I only found one in about two people per 100 people I'd interview, or women that I would interview, would indicate that they were using birth control. It began to develop clearly in the 80s. USAID, the American government, began to pour a lot of money into Egypt, and one of the major efforts was to try to control this horrendous population growth in this very limited amount of land. And by 2005, you'll notice that 71% said that they are now using some form of contraceptive. 57 are using it, and over 70% have used it. And that clearly explains the lower birth rate. Okay, population, people everywhere. The villages are crowded. And when you go into a village, you see animals and people crammed together, living in a very, very difficult environment. Now, I have to show you this because this was a very interesting history, and I think I have time to share this with you. In 1992, the Egyptian government announced that they were going to undo the land reforms of President Nasser that were imposed in the early 60s. And what they did was essentially to allow all of the tenant farmers, not the owners, but the tenant farmers, to gain control of the land that they were working on, so that the landowners were denied access to their land from 1965 to up till 1992. In 1992, the Egyptian government announced that all of the lands controlled by tenant farmers could now be returned to the original owners. Now, when that was announced, I remember a number of scholars who said, if you take land from these peasants, because this is their only way of survival, if you take this land away from the peasants and give it back to the landowners, you will create a revolution. There will be a revolution in Egypt. And when they announced it in 1992, they said, we have 5 years for you to prepare. And if you farmers can't renegotiate a tenant relationship, then you're going to have to find work someplace else. And over that 7-year period, about 500,000 tenant farmers lost access to their land. And again, the assumption was this will lead to immediate revolution. And what I want to spend just a minute here, is to explain why there was not a revolution in 1995, 96. Why didn't the peasants revolt? And this is what I want to show you. You'll see that landowners were about 623,000 farmers. By 1985, landowners were about 1.3 million. Landowners by the 2000s was 3,200,000 farmers. Okay, so a great increase in number of owners. And then you have the tenants who own no land, but they were working as tenant farmers. They'd pay rent and work their land. And it was about 500,000 in 66, dropped a little bit to 400,000. And today it's about 200,000 are tenant farmers that own no land. And they're the most vulnerable. The tenant farmers with no land of their own are clearly the most vulnerable farmers in Egypt today. The owners that also rent was also about 500,000. So these would be people who own some land and then they rent additional land. And you can see that group has gone down significantly the same way, from 400,000 to down to about 300,000. But the total renting, as you can see, is about 500,000. So the question is, what does that all mean for the villagers? So we did a sample of villagers in 2005, and we asked them the question, are things better in your village? Are things about the same? Or are things worse? And this is what we found. We did this in 50 villages, a representative sample of the 5,000, and we interviewed 50 people in each of the 50 villages, about 2,500 people we interviewed. And from that group, we found that 46%, a majority of the villagers, all the villagers agreed that things were better. Now, how in the world could they be better? I have to explain that. Another 18%, a majority of the villagers said it was better, so that two-thirds of all the farmers in Egypt said things are better after this land reform had been repealed and farmers now have access, and the landowners now have access to their land. Two-thirds said things are better. Well, how is that possible? Notice that things are about the same. You can see that's about 16%. But this is the group that we were concerned about. It was about 20% of the villagers, 20% of the villages said that there had been a serious violence in their village. Serious violence. As these landowners came in and took land back from the tenant farmers, there was violence. But not the 100% of the villages that some people were suggesting would happen. It wasn't 100%, it was about 20%. In fact, of the 50 villages, there was only 10 villages out of 50. 32 said things are better. 8 villages in the sample said things are about the same. And then 10 villages out of the 50 said they had had serious violence. Now, the way I can explain it is very simple. If you were a large landowner and you took land from these tenant farmers, you had a problem. Because the peasants felt that the big farmers didn't need more land. They already had 50 acres. Why do they need my 2 acres? Why do these rich farmers need my 2 acres? And so in those villages where the large landowners were taking land from the small farmers, there was violence. But it wasn't 80%. I mean, it wasn't 100% of the villages. It was about 1 in 5 you'd have that problem. The other situation was, what if you're a farmer with 2 acres and the government takes that away from you and gives it to a tenant farmer? How do you feel? You're just a little farmer. And in the villages of Egypt, among the small farmers that were landowners who got their land back from the tenant farmers, the villagers unanimously said, that's only fair. These small farmers should have access to their land because they were impoverished. They didn't have access because the government had essentially set the rent rate so low that someone renting 2 acres didn't have any surplus, and so he paid a very small rent. So this is one of the most interesting changes that's happened in rural Egypt. Now notice how being landless is related to poverty. If you are very rich, if you perceive yourself as very rich, you'll notice that 15% have no land. That means they're probably merchants, and they're probably government officials. They're very rich. They don't have any land, but that's okay because they've got other access. They have other resources. If you have less than 1 acre and you're very rich, you're still well off. You might have a half acre, but it doesn't matter because you've got other resources. So 21% of the very rich consider themselves, they have no problem. The problem is when you get over to the somewhat poor. 84% of the somewhat poor have no access to land, not even an acre. And among the very poor, 90% have access to less than one half of an acre, let's say, on average. Yes.
How big is a
fedan? A fedan is the same as an acre. Good question. Yes, a fedan is about the same as an acre. Okay. Now, notice this. If you want to increase your income in a village of Egypt, in 1967, 81% of the adults said, I want my children to work for the government. I want my children to work for the government because they're going to pay good salaries and I don't want my children to be farmers. I want them to work for the government. So in 1967, 81% thought their children should work for the government. Only 24% wanted their children to be farmers and only 5% wanted them to be in the private sector. In 1966, Arab socialism didn't speak well of the private sector. It didn't exist, except among some merchants. By 1985, farming as a possible profession had grown a little, but certainly the government's favorability had dropped significantly from 80% to 58%. But for me, what is most interesting about the future of Egypt is the fact that today, 43% now see farming as a reasonable career. That's a significant jump from what it was in the 60s. But what's more interesting to me is nobody wants to work in the government because the salaries are so low that they can't live on the salaries of the government. And that is what brought the private sector from 5%, 8 times now greater, preferring some kind of private sector government. Okay, how am I doing for time? All right. Agriculture was, if you have one source, If you have one source of income in a rural village, 32% get their income mostly from agriculture, but 39%, if you only have one source of income, where does it come from? 40% of the villagers get their income as a government job. Now, if you have two sources, you'll see it's even the agriculture becomes more dominant. But what I just wanted to show you was that government service in the villages was considered as the way to survive in those early days. I just want to take 1 minute to show you that the bottom 20%, notice what happened between 1990 and 1995. In 1990, the bottom 20% of the villagers had 8.7% of the wealth, okay? By 1995, what had happened? Their share of the wealth had dropped. It dropped from 8.7% of the wealth to 5.8% of the wealth. Now let's look at the top 20%. At the top 20%, that 20% owns, in 1990, 41% of the wealth, okay? And by 2005, what had happened? Their share of the wealth had grown from 40 to 45%. So while the poor are getting what? Poorer, the rich are getting richer. And that, of course, is the challenge. You'll notice the second, third, and fourth quartile, statistics remaining pretty much the same. Okay, again, if you're very rich, do you consider yourself very comfortable, reasonable, or your income's inadequate? It's not too surprising that most people, rich and somewhat rich, are comfortable or reasonable. But look at the very poor and the somewhat poor. 78%, 85% indicate their income is simply not adequate. They're struggling. They're really struggling. Now, this is a rich landowner. He owns 50 acres. He probably has two or three TV sets. Has a nice pigeon tower there where he raises pigeons. He owns probably 50 acres. Beautiful home, palm trees. It's very nice. He lives very nicely. But he is less than one half of 1% of the population. Okay. Now this Gallup poll did a well-being study. Denmark, 82% of the people in Denmark thriving, 17% struggle, and 1% are suffering in Denmark. Compare that with the United States, 51% are thriving, but 47% are struggling in the United States, and 4% are suffering. Indonesia and Egypt are about the same. Egypt, 16% are thriving, 71% are struggling, not too surprising, but 14% are really suffering. And that's this landless group that have no access to land or resources. Zimbabwe in Africa, they've got problems. Okay, now I'm going to turn very quickly to politics because I want to show you that historically the elite tended to dominate in the villages. One family, one big influential family, controlled in 1966, 58% of the villages. By 2000, that had dropped to 10%. And two or three families, it was 35 and it was 53, dropped to 18. But what's encouraging for me is to see the power of these large families, these dominant families, their influence has greatly, greatly dropped in their impact. Do big families control the elections? I'd say so. In 1966, yes, always big families control the elections, 76%, then it drops to 61%. Today, it's still 40%. Still 40% of the elections are controlled by big families. Yes, sometimes, seldom or never. It's interesting to see that that's gone from 6% up to 20%, so there is some democratization going on in the villages where smaller families, less powerful families, have some access. But this was one chart that I thought was really interesting. We asked them this question: did you vote in the last local election? And then, if you voted, did your preferred candidate win? And you'll notice that the number of people who said, yes, I voted, was 27%. That means that 73% didn't vote in the election. Among those who did vote, and I have to share with you, they said that their preferred candidate, 96% of the candidates that were elected were preferred by the people who voted. But now look at the people who didn't vote. Did their preferred candidate win? It's just the opposite. It's 94.6% of the candidates didn't win, and they were the ones they wanted to win, the poor people. And I have to share with you, I've done the statistics on this. Those who voted are the elite of the village. And so the people that they elected were people they wanted. The poor members of society, they didn't vote because they knew there was no use to vote. At least they, in their minds, there was no reason to vote. And the reason they voted, because there was nobody on the ballot that represented them, their preferred candidate. Okay. Having a democratic form of government, is it very important? This was some statistics that I ran in the 90s and early 2000s, and I was very surprised to see the jump that had happened. In 1992, 38%, and if you say, if you add the 38 and the 39, that's almost 80% of the villagers in 2009 said, we think some kind of a democratic government would really be helpful. By 2000, it had jumped to 97%. Most rural Egyptians want some kind of government, and I want a democratic government. And notice this, this was in 2005, is a democratic system a very good system? Notice in urban Egypt, it was 51%. Rural Egypt, 62% of the villagers in Egypt wanted some kind of a democratic system. And that's why I'm now going to finish up with the minutes I have to talk a little bit about the political situation in Egypt today. There are four major groups in Egypt. There's the Salafists, the Nour Party, about 3% of the population. The Salafists are what I call the extreme members of the Islamic community. Many of them advocate violence. Many of them want an extreme form of Sharia law in the constitution, and they are actively seeking to impose a Sharia system on the people of Egypt. You then have 25% who are the conservatives. The conservatives are Muslims. Many of them belong to the Muslim Brotherhood, but they are what I would call much more conservative. They restrict their children, their girls, going to school. They make their daughters cover their faces. They don't believe in violence. The conservatives abhor violence, but they are very interested in creating some kind of a Sharia system. And they're hoping it will be done through a democratic process, if possible. Now, the moderates, which are 38% in the rural areas of Egypt, these are Muslims who believe that Sharia law is not necessary in the modern world, that Sharia law in its more moderate form is appropriate, but it doesn't necessarily need to be in the constitution. And for me, this is the future of Egypt. The moderates are the future of Egypt, because the next group down are the liberals, and these people tend to be members of the Waft Party, which want a constitutional democratic system. And then you have the secularists. These are the former supporters of President Mubarak, and they would like to have a more secular form of government established. Now, the election that took place in November of 2011, notice what happened. 66% of the members of parliament in 2011 voted for Islamist candidates, which means Salafists, conservatives, and moderates, okay? And the vast majority of that support came from the moderate group. They were the biggest group. But I was very, very interested in the presidential election in June of 2012. And I want you to see the difference. Morsi, who represented the Islamic community, the Muslim Brotherhood, only received 52% of the vote. Folks, think about that. You got 52% of the vote. When 66% of the people voted for Islamist candidates in 2011. And I want to suggest to you that something very dramatic is happening in Egypt. Very dramatic. The moderates are really torn. And what you'll see is that of that 38%, 24 continue to vote for Morsi because he represents a more Islamic perspective, but I would argue not an extreme perspective, a moderate perspective. They voted for him hoping, praying, that he would present a moderate form of Islam for the people of Egypt. He has not done that. President Morsi has essentially moved to the right and considers the Salafists and the conservatives as the basis of his power. But what he has to face up to is that he lost at least a third of his support between November of 2011 and June of 2012, because 24% stayed with Morsi, but 14% of this moderate group went with the more non-Islamist tradition. Now, my conclusion to that is, Egypt today is in a serious crisis. Some would call it chaos. Morsi was an Islamist candidate, and most good Muslims would vote for Morsi because he was a good Muslim in their minds. But the Morsi government, unfortunately, has failed. Employment is out of sight. Demonstrations and the frustration of people with the poor system of government that's now in Egypt is forcing many people to rethink their commitment to an Islamist perspective. And there will be an election in April. And I'm predicting that 38% will go with a non-Islamist perspective. Now, why do I believe that? I believe that because I see many moderates already moving against Morsi. That was a pleasant surprise to see. Because the vast majority of the Egyptians do not want Sharia law. They do not. They're good Muslims. They believe in Islam. But they do not believe the radical, more extreme forms of Islam should be the basis for government. And they're asking for a new system of government, a system of government that's based on principles of good governance. And good governance for me simply means a society where the government is accountable to all of the people, good governance where there is transparency in how the system is run, and there is a kind of participatory approach to government in which all members of society have a right to function within that community. Now, I think I have about 5 minutes, 10 minutes. How much do I have?
10.
Thank you. Good. In the last 10 minutes, I want to share with you some thoughts about what I think we've learned today. Egypt is in a terrible situation. There are those, and I would say 28%, the Salafists and the conservatives, clearly want a Sharia system. And for them, that is the only system of government that they will accept. And unfortunately, many of them are willing to use violence to impose that on the majority of the Egyptian people, because the vast majority of them, moderates, liberals, and secularists, if they will work together, and that, of course, is a question that we will have to wait for history to answer, but if that 38, 17, and 17, if that group of Egyptians will work together and elect candidates who acknowledge Islam as their religion, but recognize that there is a place in society where religion is appropriate and there are places where it's not appropriate. And to impose a Sharia system in their constitution is not appropriate. And most Muslim countries that have adopted a more democratic system, Malaysia, Jordan, Turkey, many Muslim countries, India, Muslim populations in India and Indonesia, have all adopted a more secular, no, that's the wrong word, a more moderate Islamic perspective, and believe in majority rule and minority rights. And it will be the moderate Muslims that will protect the interests of that 10% Christian in Egypt. If the Salafists ever gain control of Egypt, the Christian minority would be in a terrible situation. If the secularists working with the liberals and the, if the moderates working with the liberals and the secularists can work together and establish a system of government that allows pluralism, tolerance, human rights, political liberties, Egypt has the potential of becoming a field of reeds. It has this incredible agricultural system that's producing, the farmers of Egypt have the highest yields in the world. Their yields are higher than the farmers in America. They are hardworking, skilled farmers. And they have not been treated well in the past. Now, the dictators that have ruled Egypt over the centuries have never been friendly to the fellaheen. And I wrote this book primarily as a challenge to the leaders of Egypt, that it is now time for them to recognize not only the contribution that the fellaheen make, they're the ones that grow the food that they eat, but they represent a majority of the people and should have a say in how that government is ruled. And that almost 40% of the Muslim moderates in the rural areas of Egypt have not been listened to up to this point. And I was very disappointed with President Morsi and his shift now to the right, to the more conservative perspective on Islam. Now, are there any questions? I think I've got time for just a question or two, if anybody wanted to. Yes, please.
What would you advise the government of the United States to do in relation to Egypt?
Can you restate your question?
Repeat for the radio audience. What would you advise the President of the United States, Secretary of State Kerry, to do? What's our policy toward Egypt?
I think here's the challenge. We believe in democracy. And we think that when a candidate is elected, he should be supported. And there was a lot of hope when the election took place for the parliament. There was a lot of concern that now there's an Islamist system seems to be emerging, which would be based on Sharia law. But the Morsi election tells me that there is a shift back away from that more extreme position. And it seems to me the United States should play a more neutral role. We've been far too friendly with Mr. Morsi, in my opinion, and we should begin looking at the broader society, and we ought to be certainly encouraging and supporting the secularists, the liberals, and the moderates, which have not been supported like they should be.
Hi, thank you. I'm Michael. I'm a senior in political science here. My question is, you touched on it a little bit, but from my understanding of the 2012 election, it seemed like a lot of people, you know, it was kind of a lesser of two evils choice, that not a lot of people were happy, or I guess these moderate Muslims that you talk about, and, you know, Morsi was more extreme than they wanted, but on the other hand, they felt like they didn't want to support someone from the old Mubarak regime. I guess, what are the chances in the next election of there being more viable candidates that these kind of moderate Muslims can actually be satisfied with, and what are the roadblocks to more candidates like that emerging?
It really is interesting. Shafiq, who was the opponent to Morsi, I was amazed he got 48% of the vote, and really was absolutely astonished that he would get 48% of the vote, because when I saw the 66% in the parliamentary election, to get only for an anti-Islamist to get 48% tells me two things very quickly. Tells me two things. Number one, it tells me that you're absolutely right. They're looking at both sides as as not being a solution. That if we go back to the old Mubarak regime, that's not a solution. And if we go to this more Sharia law orientation, that's not the solution. And they're faced with two, and they're looking for the lesser evil. What we need is a better. And who that would be is open to a lot of discussion. And I know the infighting and the indiscussions that are taking place within the political opponents of Morsi either will come up with a candidate, and there are several that could play that role if they will emerge and take a stand. There's a lot of fear in Egypt. Some of the opponents have already been assassinated and attacked by the Salafist types in Egypt, so there's that fear. But that seems to me to be the key as to whether or not they can come up with leaders that don't represent either of those two extremes. One more question, please.
So my question is, even if they do get someone into the office that's going to help them shift from this extreme Islamist point of view, how are they going to keep that person into the office and to help him exercise his power when they have all these other people that are going to be moved to violence? And like you say, they've already been assassinated, many of them.
Egypt historically has been a nation of tolerance. I mean, Christians and Muslims historically have lived together in relative peaceful relationships. When you hear of a Christian village being burned or a Coptic being assassinated, it's coming from this less than 3%. That's the group that's causing those kinds of problems. They are criminals, and they need to be prosecuted, and they need to be challenged and confronted and hopefully eliminated from the political process. So I'm not speaking from any sense of naive optimism about the future of Egypt. I have great doubts and fears for the people of Egypt, because it takes just a small handful of brown shirts for a Hitler to take over all of Germany, or a Mao Zedong to take all over China, and it just takes a little violence for an extremist to take over in a country like Egypt. The beauty of Egypt, or the positive aspects of Egypt, has to be the number of people that are educated. I mean, education has taken a wonderful sweep forward. More and more people are educated and are not illiterates, and they are looking for a better system of government that would provide them with jobs and with freedom and with opportunities. And if that happens, then Egypt will have its field of reeds. As the Egyptians say, inshallah. Thank you.
This concludes today's forum. Thanks for joining us.